Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of the Threatside Podcast. Today, I am joined with Delirious.
Hello!
And a very special guest by the name of Wayne Tussler, also known as Josip. Hello.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me.
How are you doing today?
Yeah, it's good. Good. I'm having like a few rest days from audits. And also last week, I took some vacation. So it's been really nice to kind of just clear the head and don't think about code and all the exploit scenarios. I've actually been like grinding the whole summer on Spearbit audits, so didn't have too much time to rest, and now I'm taking like some time off.
That's very good. Sometimes you just need breaks for mental clarity, you know, and so that you can carry on focusing. To be honest, this does actually link, I guess, a little bit. Do you ever get burnt out then? Or is this something that you just kind of, I don't know, never run into, but you take the precautions to avoid it? How does that work for you?
Yeah, to be honest, I think like two weeks ago, I think I reached that level of a burnout. I don't know what others are saying, how it manifests, but I was constantly tired, throughout the day. I would attribute it maybe to a combination of things. Well, obviously, one of the things is just working every day for months, or kind of maybe grinding and working too much for a longer extended periods of time, like for the whole year. But it also can be due to maybe like weather changes and and so on. I would say I reached that level like 2 weeks ago, and then my brain wants to work more. I want to get to a new audit. I want to start something new, but then I kind of just decide, okay, maybe nothing will happen. If I take like a week off.
I agree.
And just kind of come with a clear head, Unfortunately, all of us are on like mobile phones and so on, so it's not like completely work-free. You still check some things. You still talk with some people, maybe arrange some deals, and so on. But it's pretty different than just like working the whole day. So yeah, that's kind of my experience. I wouldn't say I experienced like a huge burnout. I don't know, have you ever experienced such a thing?
Personally, not too much. The way I see this type of work style, I see it more as a hobby that pays rather than something that you have to, kind of force yourself to do or something. I feel like if you adopt that mindset, it's like almost where you don't kind of run into burnouts, maybe. It's super subjective, right? So it's like I can't say this generically, but it's like I feel like if you truly enjoy something, it's like you can still probably get burnt out, but nowhere near on the same degree as if like you had the perspective of it's just a job that you get paid for. If it's a hobby, you view it kind of differently, because like you say, it's like even when you're on a break or something, you'll still use your phone, you'll still set up deals, etc. And that I would just always see that as a hobby that you just enjoy doing. It's almost kind of on par with like kind of working, but you don't look at the clock, right? As they say, you just do it because you just like it. So I think it's a bit of a 50-50, to be honest. Like there were probably cases where I was burnt out, but for the most part, I don't want burnout to exist because it's just like, if I allow it to exist, it will probably run into me and I don't want that. So yeah, that's kind of my stance on it.
Yeah. Concerning me, like I'm on the other side of the spectrum. I'm a burnout expert. Yeah, to be honest, yeah, I experience a lot of burnouts in Web3, like especially that I'm still a dev full time, and apart from that, like I'm doing Web3 part time. Like, of course, I don't know. I think I have to like switch totally to Web3 only, because like it's really hard to manage both, and especially if you work 14 hours a day like me, like not every day, but many days I do, then yeah, it's taking the toll on you. And like twice a year, I have to take, you know, 1 month off and go like really easy on myself. And yeah, I do experience burnouts then, and I have really to take a month off. Yeah, but you know, I'm just crazy. I work like 12, 14 hours a day. So it's just me. I'm stupid.
Yeah, I mean, that's insane. I mean, no way I could work a full-time job and then do Web3, you know, security on the side. I mean, this is personally, but yeah, I mean, I like to kind of focus on one thing. So I cannot go, you know, extended periods of time, you know, focusing on like multiple multiple fronts. I just kind of get, I don't know, I get demotivated maybe to do one or the other. It's something that that happens. Also, to get back on the burnout, I think for me personally, the burnout also comes from maybe overthinking some things. You know, I don't know. You pick an audit, but then you think, oh, maybe I should have done something else. You know, or you just look back. You know, what have you done in the past like 3 to 6 months, and then you start thinking, okay, I should have maybe done something else, and so on. So this also makes kind of a toll on you. It just kind of it can be a bit burdening. I sometimes experience that, but yeah, as Escrow said, it's best to take things like lightly. Don't you know, not overthink stuff and not kind of burden yourself with some even some like dumb things sometimes. So I think that can help a lot. If you want to work like hell, I think you have to like be just very light on things.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, like this is really cool what you said about this negative thoughts that are killing you. Like, I think that many people have those. Like, you know, you are like in the middle of the contest and you can't wrap your head around it. And you think to yourself, well, I'm really shitty at that. Should I do that even? Like, maybe it's the contest is not for me, or maybe I'm, you know, just not good enough. You know, maybe my whole life is a lie and, you know, I should not pursue it. Yeah, but definitely.
Like, yeah, yeah.
Minimizing the negative
parts. Yeah, I think this is eating up a lot of people, you know. I mean, not everyone is super, you know, honest and straightforward about this. But you will see, you know, maybe even people like talking directly or through Twitter just mentioning, okay, I don't know what to do, you know. Every other platform is announcing big contests, but I'm maybe doing a private audit, you know, I'll miss out on this chance and so on. So a lot of people feel this, and it's kind of stopping the progress because you can't kind of focus on one thing. And obviously we are working in a global industry, which competition is really, really high compared to, you know, if you're just kind of locally competing with the people, you know, in your town or even your country. So that also, you know, maybe it's not best, you know, to compare yourself with others and so on. Just kind of pick your battles and just move forward, I think.
I think it's always very important to actually address these sort of things on the episodes of ThreatSide, because it's like every single time that researcher, you know, logs onto Twitter, it's like they see a lot of bounties, like people getting paid out. And, you know, and if you're a researcher who doesn't make a lot of money, it's like you're going to constantly think where you're going wrong, right? But at the end of the day, there's nothing that really separates you much from another researcher. Like, you have the same problems, whether it's burnouts or whether it's imposter syndrome, right? Like, at the end of the day, you get paid to think. And if you don't think clearly, you're not going to get paid. So it's like mental clarity is literally everything. But yeah, I definitely agree with what you're saying.
Yeah, this is a very good sentence. Yeah, you're basically paid to think, and yeah, anything that is distracting you from that, it's just like slowing down your progress. That's about it. Yeah, a very good way of thinking. I'll remember this sentence.
Yeah, 100%, and Windhustler, concerning you and your career, like you started as petroleum engineer, isn't it?
Yes. Should I give you some background
Yeah,
about my like transition
definitely.
and so on? Yeah, so actually I'm a petroleum engineer by profession. So I've graduated with a bachelor's and master's degree in petroleum engineering here in the capital of Croatia, Zagreb. And this is in 2015. So as any new fresh graduate, you know, I got employed in this big corporation as a petroleum engineer. And I kind of, you know, I spent 2.5 years on that job, but just at one point I kind of got fed up with everything. Petroleum engineering is it's a good engineering field, but the work environment is it's kind of strange. It's a very dying industry. You're kind of mostly tied to these big corporations. So I just didn't see myself, you know, advancing in that industry for the next 30, 40 years. At that point, I was in my early 20s. So I was kind of either I'm going to change my career now or I'm not going to do it at all. You know, it will be hard when, you know, when I turn 30 and so on. So I just started researching on the internet what can I do, you know, what are some other like career paths I can take. And you know, programming and coding and IT has a very good marketing, I would say, anywhere on the internet, especially if you're coming from a technical background. So I was already an engineer, and this was something I can easily, you know, just slide into. So I didn't attend any boot camps. I just taught myself how to code. I quit my like full-time petroleum engineering job, and then spent another like 7 to 8 months, you know, just studying programming through some courses, and then I got my first job. This is 20, so also to give you some sense of a timeline. So this is 2018, and unfortunately, my first job was like a corporate Java job. Not in a big corporation, but a smaller, like 100 people company, and this really sucked. So this was probably the hardest period of my life, because I've just, you know, quit my corporate, you know, petroleum job to just land another like shitty corporate job just in the IT industry. So you know, I was kind of looking to advance from there to you know to change jobs. That took some time, and then eventually in 2021 I landed like a job in the crypto industry in a smaller startup here in Croatia. And this is, I would say, the period when you know I'm starting to reap the benefits of making a career change would start. For the first few years in the industry, I was working as Solidity engineer. I've changed like a few startups I worked for, and eventually last year I kind of decided to go full into security research or auditing, and kind of just follow this trajectory of an independent security researcher. You know, just market myself on Twitter. You know, network with other people, and you know, kind of trying to make my pay through bug bounties, contests, private work, and so on. And it's been quite successful, I would say. Initially, I was like, the first 6 months, I'm not going to earn. You know, that was my expectation. I'm not going to earn much. But then it was quite different. You know, from the beginning, I was able to kind of deliver results on competitive audits and elsewhere. I would say my programming background, but especially like Solidity background, helped a lot. So I was already kind of familiar with all the intricacies of Solidity, you know, the language itself. Also, I had experience with certain like business domains, so that helped like enormously. So yeah, this is I would say in a nutshell my business like path for the past like 9 years. From petroleum engineer to software developer, and now to security researcher. Like unfortunately, a lot of changes, you know. But yeah, it's going very good. So
Amazing, like especially especially your Web3 career. So it definitely didn't go as you planned, but you know, that's not like good for you because yeah, you started to earn some real bucks since the beginning. Amazing, amazing, great to hear. But like, I think that many people are having really interesting stories of like moving into crypto, especially like those people who think to themselves like, well, I'm fucked. I mean, like, I'm fucked because I will probably stick in the workplace I hate for the rest of my life. So what can I do with it? And like, I heard many stories, and we had like many guests here in this podcast that had, you know, the similar story that, yeah, they just got fed up with their current job and they decided to give Web3 a go. And like, it turned out really good for them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. A lot of people, even without young people, you know, that didn't go to college, also some others that have some, you know, strange backgrounds, but they kind of end up in this field. And I mean, I don't see any like field that where you have so much opportunity to be honest, to immediately start earning. That's where everything is very open, you know. So yeah, I would personally, I would recommend any like fresh graduate to give it a shot, you know, at Web3 general and also Web3 security. I mean, despite some like bad rep that crypto industry has in general, because all of these, you know, scams and so on, but if you look at the other side, the openness, you know, it's really good, you know, for people entering. So
in regards to, you know, the overall Web3 security and auditing and whatnot, do you have like any sort of favorite bug class? Like, you audit a code base and you maybe search for this one specific bug class, or, you know, anything of some sort? Does that exist for you? Or?
That's an interesting question. I have like a lot of experience with these cross-chain apps, you know, Layer Zero, also these other messaging protocols. Especially with Layer Zero V1, I've spent like a decent amount of time finding some gas-related issues. You know, this 63-64, you know, portion being forwarded to external calls, you know, in external, you know, function call. So I actually found a lot of bugs around this point. Also, just in general, around these cross-chain apps, where, you know, an automated entity like a relayer is broadcasting the transaction on the receiving chain, and then there are some assumptions here. You know, you cannot rely on the message sender to being the user. So there are some things I'll look at here, but I wouldn't say it's a particular bug class. It's just, you know, when you kind of audit a lot of similar projects in a specific business domain, you just see similar type of issues, you know, over and over again.
Definitely.
So yeah, I would say cross-chain has definitely been like an area where I find a lot of things. So yeah.
So what are like the most important, like the most interesting bugs for you concerning cross-chain protocols?
There was this like really interesting bug with it's a bit maybe now old, I would say, because there's already like Layer Zero V2, so this was with Layer Zero V1. So they had this Layer Zero V1 had this like strange had the strange design where on the level of their protocol there was like enforced ordering of messages, and then each application kind of needed to build like unordered messaging. So it doesn't matter, you know, if you send message number 1, 2, 3, you can still kind of deliver you can still deliver message number 3 if you haven't delivered one or two. So there was kind of some points on how most apps would screw up this disintegration. So this was quite interesting. Also, you know that anyone can submit permits on someone else's behalf. This was also one like interesting bug that Trust Security found. There's commonly issues with this. If the relayer is kind of submitting also permits on behalf of a user, then you can DOS. Usually you can DOS this section by just kind of front running the permit, first submitting the permit, and then this other transaction is kind of being DOSed. Although these types of issues usually aren't, you know, kind of critical or high impact, that they're just kind of temporary DOS. These would be maybe two interesting like bug classes. Obviously, you know, other bugs are just kind of business logic related. So it really depends, you know, on a specific protocol. You just have to understand the math, understand all the moving parts, and then see where it doesn't fit. Also, I usually look when I see a code base, I usually look for any kind of, you know, admin controlled, you know, setters for things, then look at how if they change at a particular moment in time, so some kind of admin controlled value, can it affect, you know, the user flows, can it be kind of front run. Usually there's also some issues around this point. But yeah, as I said, otherwise it's just understanding the business logic, you know, just drilling through business logic and looking at what can be done there.
Amazing. So cool. Yeah, like we found multiple issues on layer zero, but not only you did like quite a few competitive audits, and like you placed won some contests, you placed like top 10 in many of the contests. And like, what are the most important things that you, you know, that made you to earn those results?
Yeah, actually, now it's been kind of some time since I've done any contest. So most of my high rankings were at the beginning of this year, and also some of them last year. But I would say the best advice for like competitive audits is trying to drill through external integrations and just try to drill maybe through some parts that other people are not looking at. Usually, like just approaching a competitive audit as your usual private audit is in my opinion not the best strategy. Unless you can really, really kind of cover anything, but you know, in competitive audits, the uniqueness of the bug is awarded, even if it's some very low likelihood and unclear impact. It can be a medium, you know, issue that can earn, you know, thousands of dollars. So I would say the best strategy is just try to focus on some parts of the code base. And just drill there, kind of really try to find something like strange, I would say.
Cool. And I remember that you were a part of C4 Pro League, like while it was functioning. I think it's not there anymore. Like right now, this is called Zenith, and like totally impressive. So how did you get there? Like anything specific that you did, or you know, you just landed there?
Yeah, so actually with the C-Force Pro League, I did get invited, but I never did any work with them. This is probably a point in time when I started to work heavily with a lot of auditing groups, including Spearbit. So there was tons of private work just coming in my direction. So I kind of, at that point, I felt, okay, I'll focus on this part, you know, leave the competitive audits a bit behind. So, yeah, I mean, I can't, you know, say too much about the Pro League. Have you competed there? I know you also had like really good results on C4.
Yeah, like we did have with sorry, not sorry, pretty good results. But no, yeah, we were not the part of Pro League, and we are not part of Zenith, but maybe one day.
So, but you had like I think private audits with, I mean, not private audits with C4, but you know, these kind of private competitions with C4, right?
Yeah, invitationals, yep.
Invitation.
Yeah, we did two invitationals, we won both. But like the rules changed now, and they are not even accounted for your leaderboard. So like in the leaderboard it's like we did nothing, but like we won them and we earned quite a bug.
Well, it's strange that you didn't get invited to the Pro League to be honest. So
I think it's talking about rules. It's very crazy the way I see like Web3 security at the minute. I see a lot of kind of drama maybe on Twitter or a lot of people voicing their opinions regarding the rules, specifically the rules of contests, right? Very like specific edge cases to the point where a researcher, it's very hard for him to get a payout on a bug that is actually there, but it's so conditional based on the rules that it's just so problematic to even like compete in the contest. I really hope it doesn't get worse, you know, in the scene of Web3 security, because this is actually a problem that's in Web2 security as well, and it almost feels like we're just going back rather than forward. It's actually very unfortunate, and it is quite annoying.
yeah, so what's the case in I'm not familiar with this. So in Web2 security, the conditional rules are even complex, are a lot more complex, or
No, I mean it's really just I think it applies to both Web2 and Web3 security simultaneously. It's really just the rules of a program, or well, in Web3 case of a contest. It's like what in Web3 there was a big contest on Contina, was it? Or was it on some other platform where was it Uniswap V4 that a lot of people had a problem with the rules regarding the bugs? I think it was, wasn't it?
I don't think it's Uniswap. I don't think it's Uni V4 since the results aren't public yet. I think you're probably talking about the Maker on Sherlock. I know there's a lot of noise there.
Okay,
Or
yeah, that might be it. Yeah, I'm not sure. I saw it on Twitter, and just a lot of people were just always annoyed, and they always just exemplified their opinions. But it's like I understood it straight away because the problem exists in Web 2, you know. It's a very, very common problem. Like you can find a good bug, and it will just get like underinflated by the judge, and it's just it's never a good thing, especially when the rules are also condition based. Like, oh yeah, like if you find this, then make sure it also does this, otherwise it's invalid. Like, I don't know. It's like when it comes to big contests, whether it's Web 2 or Web 3, it just it never looks too healthy for the community. And I really just hope that Web 3 doesn't turn into another Web 2 security problem. Yeah, because it would be sad to see. Like, I feel like we're really moving in a good direction in terms of like payouts and stuff, but. I don't know. I don't know. It's a bit of a weird thing.
yeah, I completely agree there. And most people quit competitive audits not because it doesn't pay enough money, not because you don't earn enough reputation, not because it's not like exciting. They mostly like just quit because it's a big pain in the ass to argue with judges, to you know, navigate through all of these rules. But to be honest, this looks like a very hard problem to solve, and this is all obviously already like discussed in detail on Twitter. I mean, there are some ideas to even have like judging as a service, but still, it's going to be very hard to solve this completely because you have to kind of you have to kind of find a compromise between two sides. Obviously, projects want to pay the least amount of money, and on the other side, also researchers, to be honest, tend to overbloat some issues,
I agree,
and they just try to maximize the impact, maximize the likelihood, and so on. And I don't know if a solution is to have some kind of scale or whatever, because obviously just having like a low, high, and low, medium, and high is not enough, you know. That there's so much variance between this.
It's very context-based.
But yeah, and
isn't
also,
it?
Yeah, it's also very context-based. And as you said, conditional pots even make this a bit worse, because
exactly,
then there's a good reason for the project to argue as much as possible. But on the other hand, these most of the contest platforms just thrive on newcomers to the industry,
mm-hmm.
so new people who just want to prove themselves,
yeah.
And I would say their whole business model is just based on newcomers to the industry. I mean, how many guys do you know that are doing competitive audits more than 6 months or you know, like a year? Very, very few guys, you know. Maybe, I don't know, Xiaoming on Sherlock and a few other guys, some guys on C4, but most people just move on to something else. It's kind of draining to do this full time for a long period of time. Only if you really like to argue with people on the internet, then maybe you're fitted for competitive. But what's your opinion, Delirious, on competitive audits? Would you, if you didn't have a Web2 job, would you be able to do just competitive audits for one year straight?
No way. Like, it's, as you said, it's so draining. Especially if you do like one after another, and like there's like constantly this kind of like fear, like whether the judge will see the issue as you did, you know, whether you did everything you could to prove the biggest possible impact there, because like after you push the report and the contest ends, like there is no explaining to the judge. Like, of course they spot judging QA in some platforms like C4, but like this is very limited, and there is, like, judge is overcrowded with all those submissions and does not really have much time on you know to argue. And like, if you were doing like private contest, if you're doing private audit, then you have team for yourself, and then you can sit together and discuss the issues and explain the full impact, you know, for the team to understand, even if they don't agree with that at the beginning, because like maybe they didn't get something. And like, but then I think the biggest part here now is like this battle royale and everyone just trying to kill each other on competitive audits. And yeah, you found something and you have like 10 comments of other people's why this is invalid issue. I had it on competitive audits. This is not very playerful. And apart from that, just the amount of time that you have on competitive audits, or you are always on the rush. It's really, really super draining. So yeah, a year is super hard.
Yeah. I agree. I completely agree there. But still, it's this is like, even with all the issues, this very healthy part of the industry, since it onboards so many people. I don't think I would be able to be at the place I'm in now if there weren't for C4, you know, and other platforms. So, despite all the issues, it's really good. I mean, that it exists, that there are people, you know, working on it and constantly improving and trying new models and so on. So, yeah, I mean, it's really great. So,
yeah, 100%. And like concerning the sponsor, I think that C4 recently, I think that they are proposing this change. It's not live yet, but there is some kind of like partial contest that sponsor would be able to see issues like in the middle of the contest, but it's like the contest
trials,
will be
trials, right?
Yeah. The contest will be just split it into multiple phases, and like in each phase, the issue that you find in this phase is worth way more than in previous phase. But like this allows sponsors to see the issues before, and yeah, like many sponsors were just asking for that before. What is your take on that, Win Hustler?
So this is maybe the existing model that is that completely encapsulates this is Hats Finance, where they just have like first reporter, you know, who manages to prove the bug, then he gets the reward. And I've tried Hats Finance, and it's almost okay. I don't want to say anything bad about Hats Finance as a company, but I don't like this model. It ends up, you know, just people spamming practically every line of code with some, you know, supposed bug. Then they start a discussion with the sponsor, and then maybe it, you know, in the end it ends up being an actual bug. So I don't like this. I mean, C4's model is a bit different, since there's a whole week, so all of the low-hanging bugs will probably be, let's say, reported by everyone who competed. But to me, I wouldn't like to compete in something like this. As you said, you know, competitive wallets are hard. You need to rush through everything. You need to cover a lot of things, and now you add this additional segment of having to rush through things, which is in my opinion not the best. But if they can find a way to make this work, I mean, it's great.
Yeah, and we also have Cantina, where the sponsor immediately sees all the issues, and like I think that in case of Euler, like when people were going rogue, that the sponsor was rejecting their issues while the contest was running. So interesting story, especially given that we had on C4 actually the case when one of the sponsor was confirmed to know about a critical issue that he just, you know, waited and reported in during the contest. What do you think about that? Like the sponsor can see everything, you know, during the audit.
I think this is fine. I don't feel this is such a big issue, because you don't have to submit the bug. You can submit bug in the last 30 minutes. So most of the experienced researchers will just submit bugs in the end. And maybe some less, and this is my opinion, obviously, I don't have some kind of data to back it up, but less experienced researchers will maybe talk with the sponsor a bit more. Maybe they'll submit a bug because they're not sure if the bug is valid. They want to start a conversation, you know, a discussion with the sponsor. And this is completely fine just to leave this option. Most of the people, you know, after maybe a few contests, you would just realize, okay, if I'm reporting early, maybe, you know, it's something can theoretically happen. Maybe the sponsor can submit it or whatever, but then you have the option just to submit it in the end. I think this is okay. There's also a lot of heat around this point on Twitter, a lot of discussion, but my opinion is it just leaves all the freedom to the researcher. You really have no benefit of submitting earlier. So it's up to you to do it at any time you wish. Another, you know, it was a bit different, as I know, in the Uniswap contest where first submissions were rewarded with extra. That's a whole different story. Then there is some incentive to be an early submitter, and then we can maybe discuss how honest the sponsor is and so on. But obviously this is also the case where you have like one of the biggest projects in the space, which is, so there is a huge reputational, you know, risk for them to basically do anything. So you also have to look at it through dance, at least I would. So yeah, that's my opinion. What do you think? What's your take on this?
Yeah, so wait, is that me directed or Delirious?
Yeah, I mean, whoever wants to respond.
Okay, to be honest, I've got quite a few points to make. Essentially, from earlier when we were talking about Hats Finance, right? First come, first serve bounties. I think that's actually pretty neat. I think it's good, but it's good for the reason that you get paid for the time that you're actually putting in. Now, there are obviously negatives with that as well, but the fact that you don't have any really sense of dupes is very beneficial, because if you've got bills to pay and you've got, you know, you've got a family to provide for, it's like you're going to be getting paid more on uniques than dupes on another platform. So it is actually worth it. The downside of this, though, I guess, is that you're under very big time constraints and a lot of time pressure, and you can really get in your own head with that to the point where it will work against you and you won't actually get paid. So it's like, again, for, you know, going back to mental clarity, it also affects your progress on Hats specifically. In my opinion, the downside that they do have, that, you know, I don't mind voicing, is just like you were relating to the spam earlier. There was a contest I saw on Hats. I never saw Hats in live production with a contest, but there was one concert they were doing like a week or two ago, and I was like, okay, cool. Well, it's first come, first serve. I wonder if they get any, you know, spams, because at that time I didn't really assume that it was a big problem on there. But anyway, you know, I saw the contest. The minute the contest went public, the Git repo already had 40 issues spammed. It was quite crazy to see. They were all invalidated, by the way, so they were pretty worthless. But it just goes to show that, you know, a lot of researchers will, or black hats maybe, you know, we don't know who they are, will try to just gain money from just automated, you know, tools, I guess. And it does question the kind of the future of these platforms. How much are they going to really get spammed with these attacks? Yeah, it's quite interesting. Then in regards to the live judging on like Contino and stuff, I think that's pretty cool. Live judging is very good, because you won't be waiting nowhere near as long as like 4 months for a payout. Like, you know, the progress on an audit is going to be very quickly on the platform. And I think that's very, very beneficial, because again, if you've got a family to provide for and you've got bills to pay, again, that's very, very beneficial. And I think it's important to have something like that.
So concerning me, I'm not really a big fan of the Hats Finance approach, even though I don't have anything, you know, against Hats, like totally fine and valid company, but the approach that they're taking, it's like, if you are able to like be quick, like even if those are, you know, some like low hanging fruits, but you are just first, like you will, yeah, you will be there. Like me personally, I really need some time to get a grasp of the code base, and like I usually don't find many issues on their first pass through the code. Like many people do, and like I don't. I'm focusing on like understanding the bigger picture at the beginning, and you know, not just cherry picking the stuff I think that, you know, might have the biggest potential or issues. So it's not for me, but definitely there are some people that, you know, are totally fine with this approach.
I think it's a very Web 2 approach, you know, because if you hunt on Web 2, it's basically first come, first serve. Especially when we talk about platforms like HackerOne. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, you think you're first come, first serve. You'll send in your report and you'll get duped on a report from like 7 months ago that hasn't even been solved. So it's quite crazy. But yeah, I mean, yeah, it has its benefits, has its negatives. At the same time, Hats is also trying to be unique, I guess, in the space. So for what it's worth, I mean, yeah, it's good to have a platform like that as well, just existing, where researchers can benefit from that sort of aspect as well.
Yeah, so on the same note, WinHustler, if you were to create your own competitive audit company, what rules would you impose there?
Now we're talking. Now... Now, at least for a few minutes, I will be a CEO of of another platform. I think Sherlock nailed it with the lead auditor. This is something that I think most projects find very useful, and they're basically sold on this fact when they have some really reputable, really really good auditor who is focused, you know, on their code base. Sherlock kind of sold it with giving a fixed pay, also having the auditor to fight for the contest spot. So I would implement this approach, and I think now other like platforms are following. You know, C4 also has a lot of terminology, but it's also just a few people that are kind of reserved to really allocate that, their time, you know, and really put up the effort to go through the code base to approach it as a private audit, not just some gig or something. So I think I would implement this. On the other aspect, it's hard to tell since this seems to be like a really hard thing to build. If we've seen all the platforms that are constantly innovating, constantly choosing different approaches. So I would probably have a lead and have something similar to Sherlock, but I think Sherlock went overboard with all of these rules and escalations and so on. I would even go as far as trying to find really good judges and having them mostly decide on whether an issue is valid or not. Not to have this whole you know, circus of comments and QAs from a bunch of people, since you can, you know, you can view an issue from so many angles, from so many aspects. Also, if you're better at writing at English, maybe you can put your arguments forward in a better way. So this quickly becomes a circus, which we have seen on some platforms where you have like 50 comments, and I don't know who is this serving. It's not helping to the project. It's wasting time of all of the researchers, and obviously one of the researchers will end up, you know, winning the debate, you know, winning the argument and maybe earning more money. But I don't see that productive. So I would kind of, I would even go as far as saying I would outsource this and trying to find the judges that maybe know the business domain perfectly, you know, and are also good auditors, good researchers in general, and just hand it over to them to kind of judge it, and maybe have some QA, but don't go kind of too crazy with this. So I'll probably implement a system like this. I'll starting. What about you guys? What's your favorite?
Yeah, so me personally, I think like Code Arena did many things good. I like, especially like if you, now that you are having the validators and judges, so validators first go, and they don't have to be judged. Like you don't have to be judged to really sort out, you know, the whether something is rubbish or possibly an issue. So yeah, this is super cool that, you know, judges were more fresh, because like previously, like judges had to judge around like 1500 issues. Like this is a lot. Like just reading whole stuff, you know, just takes ages. And right now we have like one or more validators that are going through the issues and they present, you know, what's left to the judge. So this is super cool. And like, of course, the institution of judge, I think that this is super cool. Here, like, okay, yeah, like, is there anything that I would change in Code Arena? Like, definitely having someone like guarantee of some like top notch as Sherlock did that is, I think it's a must. And I think that the Sherlock did amazing thing with their ranking system and lead senior Watsons, because like if you are doing super cool and then you compete in some audit and you did really bad job, you drop in ranking and you can lose your lead auditor rank, and then you cannot have this, you know, juicy money from that. But like on the other hand, like contest spots for people that are not leads are not that big on Sherlock. It's like many times that, for example, the lead earns like 15 grand and like all the other people just have 8 grand to split. So this is, you know, hard to really draw a line, but I think that some kind of connection between C4 and Sherlock would be amazing.
That is true.
Yeah, I agree that the pot size is not that huge on Sherlock. But you're kind of not just competing for the pot size, you're competing for the lead Watson position as well. So you might be competing for points as well. So that's kind of on the line. But yes, I mean, if you would pay a huge pot and the lead and plus some like fee that the platform takes, it would even, it will skyrocket the cost of these competitive audits. So maybe not as many companies would do them. So yeah, hard problem to solve, to be honest. And I think all the platforms are doing a pretty good job, you know, kind of innovating and trying different things. I even like this live judging from Sherlock. It's kind of trying to do something differently, you know, and just kind of moving the space forward. I think that's really good for the industry in general.
So I think we do need like every platform to be different. Like, yeah, cool, they are competing against each other, but they are quite very different in many aspects. But it does allow the auditor to really choose what platform they want to be on, or really just kind of have as a main platform, I guess. Like, you'll see a bunch of researchers, you know, hunt on Code Arena and Sherlock, but some researchers do only hunt on one platform, right? Some even hunt only on Immunify. So it's quite interesting, actually. What do you guys think of Immunify, out of curiosity? I think they have a very, very good approach. But I'm curious to hear your thoughts.
So you're going to have to explain me. I've seen that they're having competitive audits, but to be honest, I don't have an idea on how it works, what the process.
Yeah, so they have the boost. I mean, I don't even know myself how it completely works. The boosts are very good from what it looks like. You do get live judging with that as well, I believe. Maybe I'm wrong, though. I'm not too sure. But the boosts, I mean, it was quite interesting to see that from Immunify, because it does just remind me of kind of like just a normal contest. But the way they executed it is very nice. And from what I hear and for what it's worth, the judging on Immunify is actually better. I don't know if it's because they're more harsh with projects and they just don't allow them to, you know, kind of save their money. They kind of prioritize auditors and make sure they get paid and get respected for their time. So I don't know. I feel like out of all platforms, Immunify is kind of in its own league in a way. You know, I'm not trying to like violate any other platform, by the way. Like I said, every other platform is unique in their own way. But I do feel like Immunify is kind of, it's more unique than every other, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and apart from that, like they do require POC for each issue, mostly. And like concerning boosts, they also have like single pot. And if many people are finding the same issue, the money is split between people. So this is not first come, first serve in boosts. Because otherwise, like, the first person that finds bug gets, you know,
everything. Yeah. I think a POC requirement is actually very good as well. Because the auditor definitely has to demonstrate that his bug is bulletproof. And it's not just, you know, a write-up that could have been AI, for you know. So I do actually like the POC approach. And it's like, again, I come from a Web2 background. So, You know, it's like you would never have a valid bug report unless you have a POC there to demonstrate it. So I feel like that's very valid for Web3 security, especially when it's just code. You know, I feel like that's even more suitable in these cases. So yeah, it's very nice to see that.
Yeah, agree. POC is extremely useful. Although there was a drama around POCs on one of the platforms. I won't name it on one of the contests. Maybe you know what I'm talking about, but the judge kind of requested, you know, everyone to write a POC. If you don't have a POC and your issue is valid, you will get kind of 50%, I think, payout. Mm. And it also caused some controversy since, believe it or not, that there's a lot of like people that don't even know how to write POCs, but are like top auditors in our community. So even this approach has its drawbacks, you know.
Yeah, definitely.
If I remember last time when I spoke with Dead Roses, I think he rarely touches, you know, Foundry or writes anything. He's just kind of manual review. His brain is working, you know, 500%, 500x, you know, and just processing everything in his head. Only if something is so complex, then maybe he'll try to write a fast test or a test or some POC or something. But most of the issues he'll just kind of find by just looking at the code. So this is also like a fine detail that matters in a contest. Since if just imagine, you know, sometimes there are contests with like 10 high issues, you know, just imagine the amount of time you need to spend for writing 10 POCs. I think recently on Code Hawks, I think it was Beanstalk contest, the person that won the contest found like 20 or 30 bugs, which is imagine writing that many POCs. So it's hard to draw the line here. I think it's really hard. So
no, I definitely agree with it. Again, it's another situation that has pros and cons, right? Going back to Dead Roses, though, I still can't believe you're auditing GitHub. I just can't. It's insane. Honestly, kudos to Dead Roses, man. That's it's amazing.
Yeah, he must have some crazy memory, because I would go insane just opening new files or, you know, clicking and so on. I would go insane after like 20 minutes, I think.
Yeah,
doing that, but yeah,
I can see the pros and cons of it, to be honest, the GitHub auditing. Like, I mean, you can have so many tabs, you can go to definitions maybe even easier than in VS Code, depending on how your go-to definition works. I've never seen it as a kind of methodology. So it was quite nice to hear that. It's just something so different that I've just never seen. Yeah, and it's clearly very successful as well for him. So again, kudos.
Yeah, like to tell you, not for everyone, but if you are like a person like him that understands and remembers the code, yeah, super cool. Me personally, it's like I stop reading one file, go to another, and I can't remember shit from the like previous file. So this is me.
Yeah.
Winhosa, do you have like any? Think... Oh wait, go ahead.
No. You can talk.
Okay. Yeah. So I'm just curious. Do you have any like security researchers that you look up to?
Yeah. I mean, most of the top researchers, I would say. I even sometimes look for some advice. Mm. For example, recently I was doing a perpetuals exchange audit with guys from Spearbit. Mm-hmm. Then I remember this Penprog, not sure if I'm pronouncing his name exactly, but his lead, Senior Watson on Sherlock, very smart guy. Mm-hmm. He always gets the lead position on all of these perpetual, you know, protocols. So I had some questions for him. He's a brilliant auditor. I think one of the top auditors, and so I also worked with Hola Daivolfi on a few audits. He's also like an extremely smart guy. He's kind of doing private audits more now, but if he stayed in the competitions, he would probably be also on the top of the leaderboard constantly. Obviously, guys like C. Michel, when I was doing Layer Zero audit, he was also auditing that code base. And when I've seen his reports and some stuff, he found it was really, really impressive, you know, the way he thinks. So, yeah, I mean, there's all very talented guys in the industry. Also, Dead Roses, I also talk with him from time to time. He is like maybe the most impressive from all of them, because he doesn't have an IT background and he's very, very young. All of the other guys, you know, have like, more than 5 years or of IT background, or they were studying, you know, computer science and so on. But yeah, you know, he's really smart.
So, extremely humble as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Very, very humble. Yeah. Very humble. True. What about you? Do you have some like guys that you look up to, or?
Honestly, I don't have a specific person. I do like to read everybody's reports though, because everybody sees code completely differently, right? That's also like a great aspect of working in a team with other auditors, like kind of like how you were working with some, you know, you get to see their insights, right? How they view a code base, how they kind of just think of attack vectors that maybe you don't, and then you learn it, and then, you know, and then you pass on that knowledge to whoever you want to pass it on to. So I feel like that's kind of beautiful in itself. Yeah, I honestly, for that reason, I don't have anybody specific. Because again, like I'm saying, everybody views code differently. So it's like everybody, in my opinion, is almost at the same level. Yeah, that's kind of my stance on it. How about you, Delirish?
Yeah, I do have quite a while people. Like, of course, those Windhuster that you already mentioned. But apart from that, Zach Obrand, who was totally not technical. And like, I think that he wrote a book, and then he decided, okay, I'm gonna do something different with my life, and okay, this crypto is fine. Oh, and this is like Solidity, some programming language, so maybe I'll teach myself programming. And bang, he's on the top. Apart from that, Gothic Shannon, this is guy that is like, oh, really, yes. He's not really visible in the space, but the reports he finds and the issues he finds, those are like totally out of the earth. And apart from that, like people I met in real life, one of them is Riptide. I met him live in Czech Republic. Amazing guy, personally, living nomad life with his family, and yeah, find some really, really good issues. And Trust, which is my mentor, like in my personal opinion, there is no one better than Trust. Like given, like he did Israeli cyber forces for I think 4 years. Then he did some low level exploitation, binary exploitation, like many stuff that he's not allowed to talk. And then he was part of how is this the company called, NGO, this Israeli company that does the Pegasus.
Yeah, it was something like that.
Yeah, and they have like some of the best people in the world, and yeah, like they are creating like no click exploits for iPhone and crazy stuff. So and then he, you know, just went into Web3, and he was like constantly in each contest that he participated, like almost each of them he found like many uniques. And each time, even now when he competes in some contest, he like he gets around half of the pot or even more.
He has some like crazy skills, honestly. I would say Web 2 definitely played a big role in that, of course. Especially when it's kind of harder, I would say, especially when you account for things like binary exploitation and stuff, and his overall experience, you know, with the Enduro group. It's crazy. It's crazy. When you see him on a context, on a contest, you know it's going to be rough for yourself. Yeah, very, very good auditor. Every time I open up the C4 Discord, I always see him AFK and on StarCraft, I think. He's been like that for like 2 years. It's so funny, but yeah. Or a year or so, sorry, but yeah, it's quite funny. Very good auditor though as well. I really like him.
That's funny because I also see that StarCraft every time. Yeah, maybe it's his girlfriend, you know, playing StarCraft on his machine.
Yeah.
And he's auditing on paper or something, you know, in the back.
Yeah. He, or maybe he's using GitHub as Dead Roses. Maybe this is his trade secret. Kids, if you want to do it free security, do GitHub.
So Windhauser, do you think AI will affect like Web3 security massively in the next few years? I may be opening a can of worms here, by the way, but I think AI is a hot topic right now, and I'm curious to hear your view on just how kind of static analyzers with that embedded into it, you know, will work out. How will that affect us, you know, and so forth.
Yeah, I don't think it will replace like security researchers, but it will be like a very useful tool. And without it, you know, you'd just be kind of left behind. I mean, right now I also heavily like use the I don't know ChatGPT or Claude just to explain something, especially if it's low level code, then you can just feed it there and it can explain kind of step by step, you know, with examples, with whatever you want. So right now it's very useful for that. I don't see it completely replacing and finding kind of complex bugs. I think it would have to kind of if it's going to be that advanced to find the most complex bugs, then we're kind of screwed with everything else in life, because then it's too smart, you know. If you can give him some context and he can find everything, then you know what other job cannot be replaced, you know. Then basically every other like intellectual job can be replaced. I just don't see it
Yeah, I agree.
being right there yet. But people that are good at writing prompts, people that are good at kind of communicating with it, and I think will have a significant advantage. That maybe the people that are a bit stubborn and just want to continue, you know, doing things in the way that they are used to. That's my kind of general opinion. I'm hope, you know, I'm not wrong and we're not going to get replaced. But yeah, there's low, I think very low ch chance that it will kind of replace or kind of make obsolete most of the auditors, you know. That's also one scenario that people fear, you know, if you're going to have to be the best auditor in the world, you know, and by using, you know, this automated AI tool, you can find all the bugs, then you don't need, you know, competitive audit, you know, you don't need other people, you don't need average people to compete. That could be a big problem, to be honest. But yeah, let's see, it's very hard to predict. I mean,
Indeed. I mean, I used Claude. I used it like a few times. It's pretty good for like again an overview of contracts or some sort of logic, like you were saying earlier. But the minute that you start like you know questioning it about any vulnerabilities or anything, it sends you down rabbit holes. People who aren't aware of that will waste a ton of time, I think. And I think even in the future, like that's going to be something that we are well AI will be susceptible to, just sending you down rabbit holes. And you know if you really rely on it super harshly, then you won't really have much benefit. You can use it for the simplest tasks, like again, overview of logic, because it's quite simple to understand maybe. I guess it depends heavily on context as well, but you know, if you've got like a, I don't know, 600 lines of code file, it's like you can give it to Claude and then you can start asking about functions, like where is this function called, you know, or something. As long as it has the other context of the other contracts, then it's pretty good in that aspect. But the minute you start asking it very technical questions or anything, it does become a bit of a chore and it does send you down rabbit holes. So yeah, for anyone that does use Claude, just don't rely on it, okay? Just use it as a little extension, I would say.
Yeah, true. I mean, I hope it will reach a point where you can feed maybe the whole repository with tests and everything, and then you can start asking like meaningful questions, you know, describing all of the test scenarios. What is tested? Try to come up with some other test scenarios. So it can kind of aid you in like different modes of thinking and then kind of different edge cases. When we get to that point, which I think we are not there right now, then it will start to become like really useful, because it will also, I imagine, it will kind of help you visualize all of this. So it can create some, you know, kind of tables with cases, with parameters, so you can more easily analyze it. You don't need to do all of this stuff in your head, but you have an actual tool that you can talk to, and this will be massive. This will be massive, I think. But also, my other opinion is, with the advancement in AI, we're going to be building more complex software. We're already building software that is too complex, but it's probably going to get more complex, because you will be able to ship, you know, faster. And so from that perspective, then also the auditor will need to use AI tools to kind of to figure out what's going on, you know. So
What do you
Oh
think,
yeah,
Bill?
I think that I saw recently that there is some guy that already has the Elon Musk's Neuralink in his brain, and he's able to play, I think, Counter-Strike with just using his brain. So maybe, you know, in like 20, 30, 40 years, we will merge with the machines and we will have like our brains and additional AI agent inside. And you know, maybe we'll be a bit of a human and a bit of a machine. Like, we'll see. If you like the cyberpunk climax, then and it's coming for you.
I think the future is going to be truly crazy in that aspect. It's very good that Elon's doing something like that. It's very bad for the way that you can take control of it from an attacking standpoint, depending on how it works. Yeah, I can see the dangers of it being massive. I think he has a mission of like, you know, restoring blindness in people as well. Pretty dope. That's very good. But when it comes to like controlling things, like computers and stuff with your mind, honestly, it's crazy how it works. Yeah, honestly, the future is going to be quite interesting. Very, very different to how it was like 50 years ago. Like, we are really advancing very quickly. I think it's going to probably be quicker than 20 to 30 years, to be honest, like you're saying, though. Especially with somebody like Elon with his mission. He values time a lot. And I think it's like, yeah, I don't know, it's going to be wild times we'll be living in.
Yeah, like
Yeah,
we'll...
it's going to be insane. I agree. I agree. I agree there.
Yeah,
So, Windhoser,
we'll
you try
see.
to grow your personal brand as well on Twitter, right? What sort of a difficulty would you assign to that? Like, would you say it's like super hard or like medium?
It depends on what type of person you are. To build a personal brand, you either have to be really funny. I'm really funny, like this. I usually use his example, but this pop punk is for me, you
Oh
know.
yeah.
I really like his sense of humor, but
Yeah,
not
gas
everyone
bad.
can do this. Yeah, gas bad and all of these, you know, jokes around third. I mean, most of his posts are just kind of jokes, but he's also talking about his business
Yeah.
within the joke. So this is, you know, you just have to be this type of person to constantly produce, you know, funny content. Another way is really producing, you know, innovative content, or some novel bug classes, or you know, kind of building our brand around that. also really hard, since obviously you need to constantly deliver something extraordinary results. Another way is just kind of generally speaking about personal struggles and some strategies you're using to add it better, to also build your brand, to get more business and so on. And this is perhaps the I would say the easiest way, because everyone is thinking about their business, thinking about their auditing strategy, trying out new things, thinking about other people. So you might as well just put it on Twitter, and see if it's interesting to other guys. But it takes like a lot of dedication to post every day, or post like a few times a week. Mm-hmm. So it is a lot of work, I would say, because it's not just you post, then you also spend some time on Twitter, you comment to other people, you respond to other comments. So it is definitely like 1-2 hours a day, additional work, I would say. But on the other hand, it also helps, you're kind of writing about something that's important to you, then you kind of clarify your mind, your thoughts by just writing about it. So it does help. I would suggest anyone to, even if you're really technical, push some technical stuff, do some bug analysis, do something. You don't have to be funny. You don't have to write about your personal life or personal struggles or whatever. But I think everyone should market, themselves in some way or form.
I definitely agree with that.
Yeah, like you mentioned that it takes an hour or two a day. Like this is unexpected for me. I didn't know that it takes so much time. Just like post a few videos, every now and then, and that's all. However,
so just a correction. So it's not like it's not like a typical 1-2 hours. It's it's more like cumulative throughout the day.
Okay.
I don't know. You enter Twitter. Maybe you want to write a comment to someone. So there's some argument around, some contest. Then I spend like 10 minutes just thinking through and writing the comment. Then maybe I'll see some article or something. Unfortunately, there's also a lot of spam on Twitter, some cat videos or whatever. Then you might from time to time spend some time on this. So cumulative throughout the day, it's definitely like around one hour, I would say. It's more if you're writing that some kind of tweet and compiling something bigger. So it's just a typical like social media usage, I would say.
Okay, so how is your typical day look like? How many hours per day you work usually?
So I wake up. I try to wake up like 7 to 8 in the morning. Then I do a few hours of work, and this depends on what I'm doing at the moment. If I'm just talking to people, then I'll talk to people. I send some messages, or if I'm maybe thinking about some tweet, I'll write a tweet. If I'm auditing, I'll audit. So it depends. Then I have I go to the gym. I do some training for around 1 hour. After that, I have lunch, and this is not now. It's around like 2 p.m. one or two p.m. after all of this. So I did like the morning chunk of work, which is like several hours. Then I have another chunk of work until like 6 p.m. something like this, maybe sometimes 7. Then I come back to home, try to spend some time with my family. And then usually in the evening, I also do some additional work. If I'm on an audit, then I will kind of push some communication with the people to the evening hours, when I'm already kind of exhausted, don't have that much concentration and so on. So it's easier maybe to respond on some messages, or if I wanted to follow up with some project or someone, then I'll do that in the evening. So this is from Monday to Friday, and weekends are a bit lighter. So it's not like this, but even on the weekends, I will do a good like block of work, like three four hours. I'll try to do.
Okay, this is interesting. You are not stopping, bro.
Yeah, I mean, not every day, you know, is perfect. You know, you have some days where, I don't know, everything sucks, you know. And some days you are kind of pumped up, you know, you want to smash everything. But yeah, I try to keep some consistency. I try to kind of push myself also to do some work, quality work every day. As I said in the beginning, my biggest block is tends to be thinking. Maybe sometimes I'll spend like an unnecessary 1-2 hours, you know, thinking about where should I do this. Since I'm a freelancer and independent, and then I kind of have to constantly organize my work. You know, it's kind of different. You don't have this aspect if you're working for someone else, because then that person tells you, okay, do this, here's the task, just do it until tomorrow, and that's about it. Being independent, you know, it's amazing. I won't go back to working for someone else, but yeah, the downside is that you have to plan, and you have to deal with kind of lost opportunities and lost chances and bad decisions and so on. But it I think builds some character, you know, along the way, so it's good.
And like you're really busy, of course, with private audits. And do you have some practice routine additionally to grow as an auditor? Or, you know, just working with the best in the space is just the best experience that you can get?
I just started to do some bug breakdowns with Spearbit. So that would be on the track of maybe doing some research on the side. But usually I'll just do audits. That's about it, and that's kind of more than enough. I'm not like I'm not type of a person that can do technical work all day, every day, throughout the years and for multiple years. There are some people that are like this, that are really kind of maybe more, I would say, introverted and more like. We really like to constantly do technical. I like to mix this. I like to have like I like to talk with other people. I like to do some. I like to write. You know, I'm not like if I would just constantly audit, you know, every day, each and every day for like 8-10 hours, I would get probably burned out. I would feel like kind of dry. What am I doing? You know, just technical work all day. I don't know. You know what's happening around me. So I'm also a bit specific on this point. So it's kind of different.
Very interesting. Very insightful as well.
Yeah.
And yeah. Thanks.
How do you approach this first phase when you try to understand the code base as quickly as possible? What is your, you know, the typical way that you go through the code base just to get the understanding of it?
Yeah, so it depends on how complex. If it's like 3-4 thousand lines of code, I kind of every code base I approach with a different strategy. Sometimes I will even start from these smaller libraries or smaller pieces of code, and just kind of trying to audit them. In isolation. Okay, this is a library that does certain things. Let me figure out what was the purpose of the library. Try to find some issues there. Maybe in some other instances, if I'm already familiar with certain parts, I mean, maybe it's integrating with some external protocol I already audited, then I will immediately obviously start from that part because it's familiar. And it's easy to kind of spread to the rest of the code base from that point. I also sometimes use the approach of just user flows, and tests are usually good for this. So, I mean, every protocol obviously has the most simplest tests, which are just a happy path, you know, through the functions, and it's quite good just to see the concrete numbers, you know. It can be a bit abstract, you know, just looking at the function with a lot of parameters, sometimes, you know, functions can have like structs which have like I don't know, 10-20 variables. So it's it can be very abstract to actually figure out what's going on there. So it's good to start from these user flows in these cases, and then I just slowly build up from that point. At one point, you start to kind of understand the code base, and it gets easier. Also, I use some pattern matching. I will, if for instance there was this perpetual exchange protocol I was auditing, I just went on Solidit, you know, typed in perpetuals, and just kind of went through the issues to maybe see some around what points, you know, were the bugs found, and then I kind of try to push it onto this this code base. So I don't know, there was some issue with like quoting in USDC. What if USDC defects from USD? There was some issue around this. Then I went to the code base I was auditing and kind of trying to force this issue, back engineer this issue onto the code base. You know, what if the packs were, let me see all of the points where something is occurring, you know, where can it break, you know. This is just one example, but yeah, I will use also some pattern matching.
Amazing. And like it's really rather simple to grasp, and as we see, extremely effective.
Yeah.
I think pattern matching is actually pretty neat, especially when you're doing, you know, it with line by line code, for instance. There are snippets of code that are just, you know, inherently vulnerable, and it's like you could actually just create a script, have a lot of 100% vulnerable lines of code, and just put it into a script and scan contracts on new code bases. I think people already do this actually. It's a very, you know, simple concept pretty much, but it's very effective as well. And it's almost like a static analyzer, let's be real. So it's definitely something good to just have as like kind of like a toolkit, right? As an extension to your already known skills. And it saves time as well. So that's actually, it's pretty good as well in that aspect.
Yeah, like I spoke with Dravi, and I know that he has some kind of detectors for that. Those are just like now the kinds of points of interest that, like, not only that, of course, he does have as you said, something that immediately shows you the issues. However, he also have the specific detectors that are just there for, you know, if you are using, for example, token that balance off address this, then, you know, maybe you can have some kind of inflation if you donate the token, something like that. Mm-hmm. And he has like multiple of these points of interest implemented. So it definitely might help you. And you know what? I personally, I think that some kind of checklists are super cool, especially for someone so chaotic as me. That one of the contests I found so, you know, simple issue with ERC20, and you know, just having a, you know, checklist of going, you know, what are the possible issues here? Like, for example, there are some tokens like BSC that will revert if you try to send zero. I think that this is BSC token, not sure, but yeah. And you know, it was one of the issues.
Yeah,
I missed, and you know, just having checklist of that, you know, would make me find this issue probably.
Yeah, it does. It does help. And you also mentioned, for instance, this address. This you can think about the donation. I think pattern matching is helpful because maybe you don't understand the code base, but you start with pattern matching, then you kind of try to reverse, you know, engineer some attack, and then, okay, maybe there isn't that sort of a bug in the code base, but you just, you know, you spend half a day just trying to force that bug onto that code base. But in the process, you kind of understood some other aspects of the code base. And then it's easier to speed up the understanding around, because you don't think too much. You just focus on that bug class and try to kind of find it in the code base. It's the consequences in the end, actually understanding the code base. So I think it's a very neat way of approaching it.
Yeah. And, you know, moving on, like, you work with Enigma Dark Labs, you work with Base Security, Spearbit, and like anything else I missed?
Yeah, actually, I think I've worked with all of these firms. So I worked with Pasha on one audit. I also worked with Hunter Security back in, it was like back in May, June. Spearbit is perhaps the biggest one. I've done most audits with them. You mentioned Enigma Dark, Bale Security. Let me just think if I missed someone. I also do some work with clients directly. So I in some cases, you know, I'll have some other researchers just recommending me to some clients, or I'll have some projects kind of directly reaching to me, or so I also do some private direct work with projects as well.
Okay, so how do you like working on private audits compared to contests, and, you know, what are the differences?
It's very different. I mean, first of all, you don't have to argue around issue severity and so on. That part is not there. Also, you have to assess the client, assess his technical ability, and try to also consult him in the process. Maybe his architecture is totally messed up, and then maybe the best to do with an audit is try to fix his architecture, you know, to be honest, not find bugs. You know, maybe he's too complex, and even after five audits he'll still not be ready to deploy. So private audits is more about communication, also kind of the consulting in some instances is very useful. And it's usually teamwork, so it's really an opportunity to learn a lot, especially if you're working with other like talented guys, then you can learn a bunch of just, you know, it's kind of researching and seeing what others are looking at and what others are thinking about. Also, you have obviously at all times, you know, someone to discuss if you found something or you're not sure if something is valid. So these are the healthiest, I would, aspects of private audits. It's really collaborative work.
Okay, so great performance consists of knowledge, experience, you know, but also like mental clarity, physical health, you know, and other. How do you take care of yourself?
I mentioned before, one big aspect there is just going to training with. In my case, it's I'm training with a personal trainer, so I'm not just going alone to the gym. This is really big aspect. I mean, obviously we're sitting the whole day, and our job is very specific. So you have to move, you know, in a healthy body. You always have also like healthy mind. On not sure what that expression is exactly, but I mean everyone knows this. Mm-hmm. So this is one thing that I'm kind of doing to improve my mental clarity, to be more focused. Also, I think just managing things outside of work, you know, having a good social life, having someone supportive within your family, if you're, you know, married or have a like a girlfriend, have a bigger family. That's very, I mean, it's very hard to achieve anything and be focused if, you know, if the things with the person that you're closest with it's not working. Also, just in general, I think everyone needs to kind of find their own peace in something, you know, try to find enjoyment in something every day. I also try to move a bit from social media, from talking to people, just find time for themselves. This can, for some people, this will be kind of walks, you know, long walks in the evening. Maybe some will meditate, some will pray if you're religious. So I also try to incorporate all of these things. So this has, I think, the improved kind of my mental clarity the most, especially in the last like few years. When I was kind of younger in my 20s, I can feel I was more like kind of eager to do some things, you know, to move, but you have to kind of stop on the ball and just kind of plan and be at peace, you know, to progress in everything in life. So
very nice insight. Do you listen to music as well whilst auditing, or is it just dead silent?
I used to listen to some music, but it's mostly like some classical music, mm-hmm. some piano or something like this.
Mm.
If I'm listening to any other music, it's just not good, you know. You can't listen to some, I don't know, hip hop, rap, or whatever, yeah. pop songs or rock and do audits. It doesn't work, I think.
Yeah, like I don't know, like synthwave or like lo-fi or something, like something that's, you know, not doesn't have lyrics, but it's got like some sort of beat that you can just kind of, you know, subconsciously ignore when you're digging into code, but like you can still like very faintly hear it, but it's like it's not enough to make you focus on it, you know, on the music. So yeah, that's yeah, I definitely hear what you're saying.
Yeah, something like that. I was never a fan of lo-fi the beats, but
mm-hmm.
I'm more like piano guy, you know, Chopin or something. I put that in the background. But even that, after 30 minutes, you know, or 40 minutes, it's I need to turn it off, you know. I don't know. It's yeah. You know, I don't feel, you know, kind of. I don't want to listen to it anymore. So
I audited with jazz once. It was pretty interesting because I don't mind jazz. I think it's pretty nice. Yeah, it was all right for what it's worth.
Yeah, jazz. You need to send me some good playlists. I think I've exhausted my pianos, you know.
You may check out brain.fm. This is app. I think that they have some trial period. I'm using that sometimes. The thing is that they have some beats and you can choose. They have different styles of music, like piano and, you know, some lo-fi stuff. Other stuff, and this is, they are not just songs, but they also have like this strange pulsing inside. So this is normal song, but if you really listen to it closely, you know, there is some kind of, you know, different pulsing going behind the scenes. And this at least the team of Brain FM is saying that it increase your focus, meditation, like depends on what you want. You have different modes, you have like deep work mode, you have like meditation, you know, and some other stuff. I use it from time to time. Like, it's pretty cool because I hate, you know, when it's like dead silent around me. And on the other hand, I can't really focus that well if I'm like listening to some normal music. So I either use some white noise or Brain FM. Like, yeah, it's worth trying.
Honestly, with Hustler, you've had very good insights. This is one of the best episodes as well. I really like the way you kind of talk about things and the way you view things as well. And then share a lot of light on kind of the importance of gym, you know, and everything else. It's always good to see this. And I'm sure the viewers also appreciate it. It's very important to also touch up on the facts like, you know, the burnouts and stuff and the imposter syndrome. I feel like that is probably the biggest benefit to the viewers who are watching us, security researchers especially, because they always have to remember that everyone, I guess, experienced them to some degree, and it's completely normal. And you know, when you're breaking code, imposter syndrome is probably more of a bigger problem than burnouts, to be honest. So it's like, you know, always remember to not get into your own head. But yeah, other than that, thank you for being a guest on our podcast. It was amazing.
Yeah, guys, thanks for having me. And yeah, I just have like maybe a few sentences about people that are trying to get into the industry of someone who's maybe just finishing his college or maybe doing a Web2 job, listening to this episode, I would just encourage them to try out Web3 security. Maybe some people would think that you have to kind of be a genius, you know, a mastermind to be good at this stuff. And some people also see these younger kids who are doing it, and then they think, okay, these are all prodigies, you know, you have to be the brightest mind in the world, you know, to do this stuff. But I think that's very far from the truth, you know. If you really put yourself into this and maybe be smart about your choices, maybe just focus on some, you know, specific type of protocol, or just focus on a specific platform, use some kind of strategy, you can advance really, really quick. So I would encourage anyone to give Web3 security a shot.
Amazing. Thanks a lot for that. And, you know, thanks for attending and being here with us. It was super insightful. We totally loved it. And I'm sure that our listeners will love it too. Thank you.
Yeah, guys, thanks for having me.
Thank you, Winhustler. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Bye.
Yeah. See you guys.